Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom land.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm Susan Gallimore with the Freedom Song to introduce this week's show. 50 years ago this month, six people began a 30-day jail sentence for sitting down at the Patterson drugstore lunch counter. On December 14, 1960, four white and two African-American college students entered a Lynchburg, Virginia drugstore, hoping to convince the owner to let them have coffee together. The result? The city's first sit-in landed the college students in jail and ignited a firestorm of controversy throughout the South. It also brought the civil rights movement to a head. Mary Edith Bentley Abusaba and Rebecca Mays Owen of Randolph-Macon Women's College, James Hunter and Terrell Brumback of Lynchburg College, Barbara Thomas and Kenneth Green of Virginia Theological Seminary and College, sat down at the lunch counter at Patterson's Drugstore in downtown Lynchburg, Virginia. They were later tagged the Patterson Six. It's my great pleasure and my great honor today to welcome Mary Edith Bentley Abusaba, who is one of those six, and Mary is going to tell us the story of that day. So welcome, Mary Edith Abusaba.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Tell us about that day.
That day was just a rather regular day for me. I had my lunch, and I was planning to go to the music hall where I would be practicing for my organ recital the next day. And Rebecca Owen stopped me on the stairs as I was going to the music hall and said, "Mary Edith, we need another person to go with us to talk to Mr. Patterson at the drugstore." Now, I had been involved in some of the meetings that we had talked about, these sort of ways that we could convince people to be more open and inviting to Negroes. That's what they were called at that time. And so I said, "Rebecca, I've really got an important lesson tomorrow, and I really need to practice." She said, "Look, we'll be back by 5 o'clock. Everything will be fine." Well, I didn't get back. I was arrested along with the other five.
How did the planning come about?
Well, what our plan was that we were going to go to the drugstore. We did go to the drugstore and asked to speak to the manager, who was the owner of it. We just thought we would have a nice, polite conversation with him, explaining to him why we thought that he needed to open his food counter to Negroes, as they were so called at that time, and that it should not be a segregated situation. And we just thought that there were six of us, two Negroes and four whites, and we were all honor students at the three colleges there. And why would he not be moved by what we said, being so optimistic as we were? But to our surprise, he refused to see us when we told someone we were there and we wanted to see him. So we stepped outside on the corner to talk about, well, what do we do next? Well, I'm thinking, I've got an organ lesson tomorrow. That's what I was thinking. And then we said, well, we can't just say, oh, well, never mind, we'll go home. And then I agreed with that. No, that sort of stubborn part of me got out, and so I said, no, let's go back in, and why don't we just go and sit at the counter and see what will happen and order coffee? And so we did, and one waitress got coffee, two cups of coffee. She handed one to me and one to one of the Negroes, and then by that time somebody had called for Mr. Patterson, and he came out in a rage, all red-faced and storming, and going down to each one of us and saying, "I want you to know that if you don't leave in the next 3 minutes, the police will be here and you will be arrested for trespassing." And we just looked at each other. We didn't say anything. We hadn't decided that we were going to sit there. We didn't know what he was going to do when we went back in and sat down. So we just sat there and kind of slanted our eyes at each other, but just sat there. And he called the police, and the police came, and they said the same thing. We give you one more chance to leave. And we didn't say anything. We didn't leave. I couldn't get up. So they arrested us, handcuffed us, put us in a paddy wagon, segregated, of course, two paddy wagons, one for the African Americans and one for us, the white people, and took us off to jail. And there they said, well, they're putting a $1,000 bond on each of our heads if we wanted to get out, or else we could just stay there in jail. And we made a phone call to a person at the college, and the college called the president of the college, and the president and the treasurer of the college came to the jail and paid the money for us to get out.
Paid the money for the Randolph-Macon girls.
Paid the money for all six of us. $1,000 on each of our heads. They paid $6,000 to get all six of us out of jail. And so then we got a ride home.
And what was the conversation on the ride home with the president?
I have to tell you, I don't remember very much about it because I think I was probably too scared to know. I just remember we went in a car and I got to the dorm and slept in my bed that night. But it wasn't so easy later when we had a trial and we were given a 30-day jail sentence. We appealed that sentence at that time because we wanted to finish our exams at the end of January, and we appealed it to a higher court. But by the time we got to the higher court, which was in February, to find out what our next step was, our lawyer and I and we had all decided that we had decided to drop the appeal and to take the sentence because we thought it would have more impact. Our activities would have much more impact if all six of us good students went to jail right there in the city of Lynchburg, and then what a mess that would be.
How did your parents take this news?
They were shocked, but they were not shocked that I was involved in those sorts of activities because my parents were of that mind. My father was a Methodist minister. My mother was a school teacher. So they were very supportive of me. They were concerned. You know, my mother said after we had gone to jail, she said, I'd never imagined that I would live to see one of my children in jail. And she said, it didn't bother me during the day. I was very proud of you. But during the night, I really, really worried and I cried about you.
After Patterson had you arrested, how did the news get out to the greater community?
Oh, it was front headlines in the newspaper. It was because the newspaper people had been called in. And they were taking pictures, I mean.
And listeners can go to the internet and do a search on Mary Edith Bentley Abu Saba and see those pictures. And you were 20 years old.
I was 21. I was an adult. One could say I knew what I was doing.
Were you prepared for the degree of spotlight that you were under?
I was not prepared for it. I didn't plan it. I didn't plan to go to jail that day. I didn't know that that's what I was going to do, but it was an impromptu decision on our part. Nobody would get up. I knew it probably wouldn't be very friendly, but I don't think I knew that it would be as bad as it was, as in arresting us, putting us in jail, sentencing us 30 days. I never imagined that.
Talk about the actual trial.
The actual trial was rather tense. We had hired an African-American lawyer, a very competent person who had done other such cases. His name was Jim Holt. The judge, of course, never having confronted in Lynchburg, Virginia, an African-American lawyer, it was tense. And the lawyer was not a shy person. He was very strong in his words, very affirming of our activities. Certainly not condemning us, of course not. Saying words that had to do with the honor of what we had done, none of which the judge would allow. He would bang his gavel and say, order in the court. This is not the road we need to be going down, etc.
There were a lot of people in the courtroom, I would imagine.
Oh, the courtroom and the streets around were crammed. There were hundreds of people in the streets. And believe me, the majority were not in favor of what we had done. They had tire chains that they were swinging around in a very threatening way. They were booing and hissing and that sort of thing. So we had many supporters there from the college and from the town, but they were in the minority.
So while this was going on, were you having thoughts of, my goodness, what have I done here?
I don't think so. I never had any second thoughts about, oh, I wish I hadn't done this. No, I think I had a sense of pride, a kind of bravery I saw myself have that I didn't know that I had, and I hadn't planned to do it, so I hadn't thought out the steps. I hadn't thought about the consequences. I mean, that's one of the advantages of being 21, you know. You don't think too much about consequences. You just do what you think you need to do.
And what about jail?
The jail was a very interesting experience. The whole town and the college and everybody surrounded was absolutely shocked that we dropped the appeal and took this sentence. And we did that on the day we went before a judge, and he was simply to refer us on to the appealing court. But before he could get on with that, our lawyer, same lawyer, Jim Holt, stepped forward at our request and said, Your Honor, the six students have all decided they want to drop the appeal and they will take the sentence. And the judge leaned over the lectern there and looked at him with big eyes and sort of shouted, Do they understand that they're going to go to jail right now within the next 15 minutes? And he said, Yes, sir, they do understand that. And I quite understood it. We had been prepped about that. I had a pair of underwear in my pocketbook and my toothbrush. I couldn't stand to go without my toothbrush. And a dental thing that I wore in my mouth at nighttime to keep my teeth straight. I had buck teeth at the time. So those are the things that I had in my pocketbook. I was all ready to spend the night in jail. And I knew that one night would go into, you know, the 30 we were supposed to have.
This is Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore talking to Mary Edith Bentley Abusaba, one of the Patterson Six who sat down at the Patterson Drugstore lunch counter in Lynchburg, Virginia, in December 1960. This spontaneous action landed the six students in jail and ignited a firestorm of controversy throughout the South. It also brought the civil rights movement to a head. This month is the 50th anniversary of those students going to jail. Meanwhile, to learn more about Raising Sand Radio and our in-depth look at progressive issues, go to our website, raisingsandradio.org. Moreover, you are invited to participate in a show. We are producing a show that shares your opinion about events in the Middle East. As ordinary people gather together with one voice to throw out heads of state in Tunisia and then Egypt, now the people of Algeria, Yemen, Bahrain, Iran and Gaza are calling for change too. What are your views on these events unfolding in the Middle East? You're invited to leave a phone message of up to 3 minutes sharing your views, and our producers will air them. The number to call is 510-545-8865. 510-545-8865. Add your name, where you're calling from, and you might also add your phone number, as we might want to contact you to expand on your views. And again, to comply with FCC rules, please no profanity. Again, the number to call, 510-545-8865, leaving your views on what is going on in the Middle East. What do you think is going to happen? What do you think of what is happening? Give us your views. And again, you can go to the website, raisingsandradio.org, to learn more. You can also contact me via email at susan@raisingsandradio.org. Now let's return to Mary Edith Bentley Abusaba, one of the Patterson Six who was sentenced to 30 days in jail for sitting down at the Patterson drugstore lunch counter in Lynchburg, Virginia in December 1960. Did she spend 30 days in jail?
Actually, we didn't spend that many nights because after we got into the jail, the jailers are the ones that told us, now you know, you get one day off for 2 days of good behavior. If you're bad, you lose those days. And we said immediately, Rebecca and I, by that time we were in our one cell together, one bunk bed on top of the other, very small cell. And we said, well, what would be bad behavior? Because I wanted to be sure and not do it. Well, bad behavior is like stuffing up your toilet on purpose or marking, crayoning, writing on the walls. And I knew I wasn't going to do either one of those. It was a very small cell with one just sort of naked-looking toilet right in the middle of the cell and a sink to wash your hands in and no mirror. And that's all we had. So why would I mess up the toilet? No, not me.
So it was you and Rebecca Owen in one cell. Where were the others? There were four more people.
Oh, yes. Well, the African-American man, the student, went where all of the Negroes were. Males, of course. And the young woman went to where the Negro women were. And then the two college students, the men from another college, there, Lynchburg College, they were with the white men. We were all segregated according to gender and race.
And the African-American woman was Barbara Thomas.
Yes.
And the African-American man was Kenneth Green, both of Virginia Theological Seminary and College.
That's correct.
Were they released early also?
Oh, yes. We were all released at the same time.
Did you get together and talk about your experiences?
It was hard to get together. First of all, we would be easily recognized. Where would we meet? They couldn't come on the college campus. Only Negroes who worked there as servants were allowed on the campus, so they couldn't come there. We couldn't get together in churches. They were off the beaten path.
And in fact, you and James Hunter are the only surviving members of that group.
That's correct. Four others have died of different...
20 days is almost 3 weeks. What in your life was going on hold?
Well, I had big events coming up. I had my senior recital. I was supposed to give my recital, had already been scheduled and gotten permission from an Episcopal church there that was near the campus that had a very, very large and elegant organ, much larger than the one we had at the college. And so the senior organ majors gave our recitals there. And shortly after I got out of jail, I was informed that I no longer had permission to give my recital at that church.
You were no longer invited because?
Because of my formidable, bad, negative, nasty reputation.
And you were going to mention another event.
Yes, I had already arranged my wedding. I was getting married the day after our graduation. We graduated on the 5th. My wedding was planned for the 6th. And 3 weeks before the wedding, the minister of the church, where I was a member, a Methodist church, called and said, now, Mary Edith, I want to know for sure, you certainly have not invited any Negroes to your wedding, have you? And I said, well, sir, of course I have. The people we went to jail with, the ones that we had been in secretive meetings with about what to do about the bad relations between whites and blacks, you know, of course I invited them. I mean, it's not very many, maybe 8 or maybe 10, or, you know, something like that. He said, I'm sorry, you may not do that. And if you're going to do that, then I'm telling you now, you may not have your wedding at this church. And I said, but the invitations have gone out to these people, including the Negro friends I had. He said, you will have to tell them they may not come. I was flabbergasted, and I called a professor at the Negro college where the others were students, and he had been part of our meetings that we had gotten together a couple of times. I had met him only a couple of times, to tell him this story. And he said, "Why, Miss Bentley," as they all called me at that time from the black community, "Miss Bentley, we knew they were not going to let the Negroes come to your wedding, certainly not as guests. We appreciate your inviting us." He had gotten the invitation already, and so had the others. And he said, "Now, I really would like it if you would please allow me to tell the others that you and I have had this conversation, and they wish you well," and so forth and so on. So I was just flabbergasted and embarrassed and chagrined, and what else can I say? Just it just felt awful. And one redeeming factor about that was that I was a scholarship student. Scholarship students frequently have to also, as many others do, even if they're not scholarship students, work in the dining room as waitresses. And so I had a lot of contact with the Negroes who worked in the kitchen. And two of them in particular, the chefs, two chefs there, were sort of part of this movement that I was involved in. And so I had employed them previously to be to serve at the reception of my wedding, and so I knew that they would be able to come because they were coming as servants. On the day of my wedding, right before I was on my brother's arm and my father, the minister, was down at the altar getting ready to go in the church, and who should come out right in front of me, come out from the fellowship hall where the reception was going to be, were Perno and Dan, the two chefs, with their very tall chef's hats on, totally white uniforms, white socks, white shoes, everything is white, and only their black faces are showing, and they had grins as big as you could see from miles, and they waved at me and walked into the church, and I gasped and had tears in my eyes because I knew why they were going in. They went into the church to sit at the back row of the church and represented all of the other Negroes that I was not allowed to invite, but they represented them, and I knew that by just looking at them.
So here we are, 50 years later, this month. This is the month that you spent in jail. Talk about the celebration.
Well, the celebration of the 50th anniversary of this is a joyous occasion, as if I had been shot off to the moon or something and came back all in one piece. And of course, the college has changed so much. And the president of the college was under terrific pressure to expel us. Terrific pressure. Three members of the board, at least, that I know about, with large caches of money, said, "If you don't expel them, we're resigning and taking our money with us." And he said, "Well, do as you will." But, I mean, I guess that's what he said. I'm putting words in his mouth. But I know that he did not expel us. He stood behind us. Now, just 50 years later, we are totally honored. Within, I think it was 8 years after that jail sentence, they had started to have Negroes at the college as students. They're no longer a woman's college. They also have men. 30% of the students are men. I don't know the percentage of African Americans, but I know that it's a goodly number.
Mary Edith Abusaba, all your life you have supported people in minority groups that tend to be discounted in our society.
Yeah, I think that's been a big issue for me, and I think it's a very normal one for me to have. I grew up in a home where my parents were against prejudice against other people. My mother had been a missionary in Cuba and was fluent in Spanish, and so she had a lot of Spanish-speaking people in and out of our house. My father regularly, I grew up hearing a sermon once a year. There was what was called Race Relations Sunday. Once a year, I would hear his booming voice saying, "The sin of racism." And I didn't even know what that meant. But that's what I grew up hearing. And my mother's stories about Cuba, and she laughs a lot after She and my father met my fiance, whom I brought home to introduce him to them, and they were surprised that he's from Lebanon and not an American. And my mother later laughed and said, long after we were married, and she and my father and my husband were just wonderful friends, she said, "You know, I think you really fixated on all those stories and pictures and things that I showed you and told you about my being in Cuba for 4 years and being amongst people that were not Americans and I'm speaking another language." And she said, "I think you fixated on that," and said, "Oh, I think I'll do that too." Which, in fact, is sort of the way it was. I spent a number of years living in Lebanon and teaching there at the American University of Beirut. Well, picking up on the theme of things that I have, how I've progressed in my life since then, I do seem to gravitate toward those people in society that I sense need the help of the majority of us. One example is that in the last few years, I've been very aware of the negative pressure put upon lesbians and gays in the culture. And I belong to a church where we have what's called a reconciling committee that looks at these issues. And this particular church has already voted to be what is called an open and inviting church. That means to anybody, no matter your sexual orientation, your race, your gender, your whatever. And so I knew that I would not go to that church anymore if they voted against it, but it was overwhelmingly in favor. So I don't like to be in amongst people who want to differentiate and be exclusive and not in, be inviting to all people. So having lived in Lebanon and lived right up against, right next to Palestinian refugee camps, I found out from a very private point of view, meeting people and having friends amongst the Palestinians and so forth, the saga of the Palestinian story about losing their land and getting squeezed even as we speak. Their land is being taken away, their homes demolished, and they just get pushed out into yet another Palestinian refugee camp. So I have been involved in that, and I worked with an organization which tries to educate the Americans about the situation of the Palestinians, and also with holding in deep respect the situation of the Israelis. We have co-workers who are Israelis and who are also there working with organizations that are trying to work for a peace and a way for both peoples to live together. I just think that everyone can and should be invited to the table.
To the lunch counter.
Yes, to the lunch counter.
Mary Edith Bentley Abu Saba, thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
That was Mary Edith Bentley Abu Saba, who participates in the 50th anniversary celebration at her alma mater, Randolph College, this month. The names of the other five participants are Rebecca Mays Owen, also of Randolph-Macon Women's College, James Hunter and Terrell Brumback of Lynchburg College, and Barbara Thomas and Kenneth Green of Virginia Theological Seminary and College. Mary Edith Bentley Abu Saba and James Hunter are the only surviving members of the Patterson Six. And again, remember to share your views on events unfolding in the Middle East. We're gathering voices to air on a radio show in early March. The number to call is 510-545-8865, or visit our website, raisingsandradio.org, to learn more. You can also contact me directly at susan@raisingsandradio. Again, the number, 510-545-8865. And let's go out with another segment of the Freedom Song.
Ain't gonna let no jailhouse turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let no jailhouse turn me around.
Hey, shut up!
Keep on walking.
Shut your damn mouth.
Keep on talking. Marching on to freedom.